We're on the record. I'm Sheila Cass. Good morning. Maryland voters are almost sure to have a chance to vote next year on whether the state constitution should include a right to an abortion. The Senate and the House of Delegates have both passed bills that would send the issue to voter referendum in 2024. Senate President Bill Ferguson spoke to the House Health and Government Operations Committee this week.
We in Maryland trust women. We trust bodily autonomy. We believe that people have the ability to make their own choices over their own health care in the privacy between them and their health care provider.
The constitutional amendment is part of a slate of bills related to abortion care, including one to assure the privacy of medical records of patients who receive abortions, and another to protect those who provide legal abortion care from disciplinary actions by regulators or insurers. 9 months ago, the Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade, holding that there is no longer a federal constitutional right to an abortion. The Guttmacher Institute, a research group, tracked 66 clinics that stopped providing abortion care in the 100 days following the ruling. The Institute reports that 13 states currently ban abortion. Against this backdrop, an abortion clinic is opening in Western Maryland. In June, the Women's Health Center of Maryland will begin seeing clients near Cumberland in Allegheny County. Joining me is the center's executive director, Katie Quinones. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Sheila.
You currently operate the Women's Health Center of West Virginia in Charleston. Why are you opening this Maryland clinic?
You know, we've always needed more clinics and more access to abortion care. That was true in both West Virginia. It's true in Maryland. It's true across the country. And it's even more true and more stark since Roe was overturned back in June of 2022. Dozens of clinics across the country have been forced to close their doors or to stop providing abortion care, like our clinic in Charleston, West Virginia. So we might be an independent clinic, but we're also part of a network of abortion providers who share ideas, who innovate together to dismantle barriers to abortion access and show up for the communities in which we live and work. So we've been engaged with leaders in the areas of education, faith, intimate partner violence, racial justice, trans and health organizers, reproductive rights and advocacy coalitions, abortion clinics, and funds to discuss the needs that they've seen in Western Maryland. And we have heard directly from Marylanders in both Garrett and Allegheny counties that more access to reproductive health care, including abortion, is needed.
Who do you anticipate the Cumberland Clinic will serve?
This clinic is open to anyone who needs an abortion. So we do anticipate, of course, providing care to Western Marylanders, as well as West Virginians, folks who are living in South Central Pennsylvania. You know, for many of those regions, we will be the closest abortion provider for them. Once we open our doors in June of this year, we will be the westernmost abortion provider in the state of Maryland.
What kinds of abortion care will the Maryland location provide?
No, on day one, we will be offering medication abortion up to 11 weeks and procedural abortion care up to 16 weeks, as well as contraception and STI testing and treatment. And then we are planning to continue expanding our services through a phased approach. So our goal is to, within year one, also start offering annual exams, breast and cervical cancer screening, and gender-affirming hormone therapy, just to name a few.
How did the end of Roe affect what services your West Virginia clinic provides?
When the Dobbs decision came down in June of last year, we immediately had to stop providing all abortion care. And we had to make heartbreaking phone calls to a number of patients that had already been scheduled for abortion care at our facility and tell them that their appointments had been canceled, abortion had been banned in West Virginia, because we, at that point, had reverted back to a law from the 1800s that criminalized abortion. And then we unfortunately had to let them know that they would have to go out of their home states to get the care that they need. We did file a lawsuit after that challenging our state's abortion ban from the 1800s, and were able to secure an injunction for a little over a month from July until September 13th, whenever abortion was banned by our state legislators. And during the time that we had that injunction, we were able to provide abortion care to over 100 West Virginians.
This is On the Record. I'm Sheila Kass speaking with Katie Quinones. She's the executive director of both the Women's Health Center of West Virginia and the Women's Health Center of Maryland, which will open in June near Cumberland, a few miles from the West Virginia state line. The Women's Health Center of Maryland will provide abortion care into the second trimester, as well as a range of other reproductive and health care services. So what changes have you seen in abortion care since the end of Roe?
The changes that I've seen that are very concerning, you know, we know that whenever abortion bans pass, they are done with the sole purpose of making it harder, if not impossible, for a person to access abortion care. So not only now do folks have to travel out of their home states and travel long distances to get the basic reproductive health care that they need, but they're also having to miss more work. They are having to spend more on that travel. They're now potentially having to spend more money on lodging, childcare. Oftentimes they're being forced to delay their abortion care to save up the money for those travel costs, which, you know, in and of itself compounds these expenses to make abortion care, the cost of the procedure, more expensive. The changes that I've seen have really been impacting patients directly in all facets of their life in very negative financial ways. And as we're seeing now with the mifepristone case in a federal court in Texas, you know, we knew that they would not stop at simply banning or, you know, overturning Roe and allowing states to effectively ban abortion, but that they would do everything in their power to, you know, make this care inaccessible. So now we see the shift of abortion attacks now being targeted toward medication abortion because so many folks have been able to successfully use it, not just around the country, but globally to safely and effectively self-manage their abortions.
Tell me more about what you're hearing from patients about access to abortion.
You know, it's not uncommon for staff at Women's Health Center of West Virginia in Charleston to still receive phone calls from patients asking, is abortion really illegal? Are you guys really not providing abortion anymore? You know, a lot of people are just truly in disbelief that this care has been banned in their home state. You know, people have needed abortions since the beginning of time, and they will need abortions until the end of time. People will always need access to abortion. So we know that people are having greater needs in order to access that care. They are needing more financial assistance because now they're being forced to travel hundreds to potentially thousands of miles away from their homes to get the care that they need. We're hearing a lot of frustration that folks can't simply get this care in their communities. It's very safe and normal reproductive health care.
The Maryland Department of Health reports that in 2020, 60% of counties in Maryland had no community-based clinics that provided abortions. What challenges do small and independent clinics face?
Independent clinics, while we receive a fraction of the national and global funding that supports reproductive health care, we provide the vast majority of the abortion care in this country. We face a unique set of challenges that, you know, hospital-based care and, you know, nationally affiliated clinical networks like Planned Parenthood don't face. We are oftentimes under-resourced, but we are the clinics that are typically providing care, abortion care at later gestation. So for people who are in greater financial need of abortion care, who need more assistance and more support to get the care that they need. We're also the ones who are, you know, more often than not located in states with legislators who are aggressively anti-abortion. So we're the ones who are oftentimes showing up and holding the line in those states, you know, at least prior to Roe being overturned, to preserve abortion access and show up for communities that wouldn't have this care otherwise.
Maryland is moving toward enshrining the right to abortion in the state constitution. Do you anticipate an increase in people from out of state coming to Maryland for abortion care?
I do anticipate more people coming to Maryland for abortion care. You know, particularly in our facility where we're going to be located in, you know, Western Maryland, we will be the closest abortion provider option for folks who are living in South Central Pennsylvania, folks who are living in above Southern West Virginia, throughout the entire state of West Virginia. We also know that, unfortunately, because Roe was overturned and no longer offers federal protections for abortion care, so now states are able to ban abortion as they wish, that we could see states that currently have injunctions in place, like Ohio, that could potentially, unfortunately, go away. And it's possible that we could see more patients traveling into Pennsylvania and therefore traveling into Maryland who need abortion care. So states that have enshrined abortion access in their constitutions are going to be really critical for people being able to access clinical-based abortion care.
Why do you do this work?
I do this work because of my own personal lived experience. I have had two abortions so far in my lifetime. The first when I was 17 and in high school, and had dreams of going to college and pursuing a career in journalism. The second abortion I had in my early 20s, right after I had graduated from college and had just begun, my life's calling, my career in nonprofit work and social justice work. The second abortion that I received was actually at Women's Health Center of West Virginia in Charleston. And the care that I received there had such a profound impact on me, the level of compassion and acceptance and affirmation that I received from the staff at every level of care, from reception to the ultrasound, to the procedure, to the recovery room. It feels like an honor to be able to do this work. And I don't believe that I'm alone in that story when it comes to abortion providers in this country. This work that we do is truly sacred. We deeply care about the communities that we serve.
Katie, I appreciate your talking to us. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Katie Quinones is the executive director of the Women's Health Center of Maryland, which will open in June near Cumberland, Maryland. Short break on the record. When we're back, the legal framework of the Maryland cannabis industry is coming together. We get an update. I'm Sheila Cass. Stay with us. Welcome back to On the Record. I'm Sheila Cast. After voters approved making recreational marijuana legal last year, lawmakers are spending this General Assembly session hammering out the details of Maryland's recreational cannabis industry. How much will consumers pay in sales tax? Where will dispensaries be able to open? And what does the recreational industry mean for the state's 5-year-old medical cannabis program? It will be a sprint to the finish. The legislative session ends at midnight on April 10th, and less than 3 months later, July 1st, is the day possession and use of recreational cannabis becomes legal in Maryland for people 21 and older. Brenda Wintrode covers state politics for the Baltimore Banner. She's been closely following the General Assembly's work to set up a recreational cannabis industry. Welcome to the show, Brenda.
Thank you for having me.
When will people be able to purchase recreational cannabis?
Well, if everything keeps going to plan, they should be able to purchase recreational marijuana legally in the state of Maryland on July 1st of this year.
On July 1st. And what will the sales tax be? How are the Senate and House approaching this issue?
This is one of the areas where the two bills came out of the chambers a little bit differently. So the House has proposed a 6% sales tax to start off, and then they'd like to increase it 1% every year until 2027, until it reaches 10%. But the Senate came out with a flat tax of 9% right away.
And would the sales tax be directed for a specific purpose?
Yes. So the sales tax is going to go to a number of different places, and there's some percentage differences here and there between the House and the Senate bill. So some of the money is going to be directed, of course, to operate the industry. The state is creating more bureaucracy to regulate and oversee this brand new commerce and this brand new market. So they need people to run that. And they're also going to be funding some public health studies. And a significant portion is also going to go back into reinvesting in communities that have been harmed by the prohibition of cannabis.
How much cannabis will consumers be able to buy?
So for recreational cannabis, adult users 21 and older can use and possess 1.5 ounces of recreational cannabis per person.
And what about criminal charges for possession? How has that changed?
Well, that actually changed when voters overwhelmingly approved the ballot referendum in the November election. And that sparked some changes almost immediately. And in January of 2023, the Department of Corrections was authorized to begin the automatic expungement of simple possession of marijuana, which previously was 10 grams or less of marijuana. So if you only had that charge or that conviction on your record, then that was going to be automatically expunged. It's not a magic wand. It's not the snap of a finger. This is a process that a department has to undertake, and they have until July 1st of 2024 to take that on.
In order to produce or sell cannabis products, businesses will need a license. What might that process of applying for a license look like?
Well, the first thing that's going to happen is we have this robust medical cannabis industry that has already been in existence for the last 5 years. So the place where people will be able to buy cannabis is at your previous medical cannabis dispensary. Many of, if not all, the medical cannabis businesses in the state are converting their licenses over to be able to sell both medical and recreational. The only difference for the consumer is going to be at the point of sale, where they will be charged a sales tax. But if you want to apply for a new license, then the state has divvied up how they're going to roll that out. Now, a big component of this bill is to ensure that communities that have been previously harmed by the prohibition of cannabis are allowed a pathway to take advantage of the financial opportunities that could exist. And they have created 2 rounds of licenses with potentially a third, but in this bill, there's only 2. And the first round, only social equity license applications can be considered.
And what do you mean by social equity applicant?
So a social equity applicant is somebody that has lived in an area that has been disproportionately impacted by cannabis prohibition. And there are certain parameters along how long they could have lived there preceding their application, or whether or not they attended a public school there, or whether they attended a college where at least 40% of the students were eligible for a Pell Grant.
Right now, there are about 100 medical dispensaries in Maryland. How many recreational dispensaries could open? You said that, for starters, medical dispensaries can convert their license to be able to sell both. But beyond that, is there a limit on how many recreational dispensaries there could be?
Yes. So since the Senate bill is still being considered, let's stick with what is written in the House bill. So right now, the House bill has 300 dispensary licenses available in total between the 2 rounds of licenses that could be given out. They also have a license in here called a micro dispensary license. And that is essentially a dispensary without a storefront. So what they're describing here is a delivery service.
The Maryland Medical Cannabis Commission reports that between January and November of last year, sales of cannabis exceeded $460 million. There are about 160,000 registered medical cannabis patients, and on average, patients spend $375 a month on cannabis. Is the availability of recreational cannabis expected to change anything for patients?
I don't believe so. the product is essentially going to be the same, whether it's medical or recreational. Really, the only difference is going to be at the cash register.
Because medical patients don't have to pay sales tax?
Yeah, they haven't up till now, and they still won't once July 1st hits.
That's Baltimore Banner reporter Brenda Wintrode on the record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking about the work of state lawmakers to establish a recreational cannabis industry. What concerns have you heard from Republican legislators as this industry takes shape?
So I think there's concerns from all legislators, not just Republicans, that the illicit market will continue to thrive. But Republicans in particular have expressed concerns about just creating a new industry in general and the economics involved. How are we as a state going to watch over the supply and demand fluctuations? If we're, flooding the market with supply, will the demand be there to support these businesses, or will we have just made something legal and without a competent marketplace to pick up the demand? I think there's also public safety concerns about people driving while intoxicated. One of the licenses that's been created is called an on-site consumption license, and those are facilities that allow people to consume and smoke cannabis in a building if they bring their own cannabis. And, there's been discussions about, well, what happens if somebody is driving to and from this location? Does this increase the expenses that our first responders and the resources our first responders are going to need because they're responding to car accidents or worse? So, yeah, there definitely are concerns on both sides.
How much money is the recreational industry expected to generate?
Well, when I look at online data from the Marijuana Policy Project, I saw that regulated adult use sales can generate revenues in the billions of dollars in some states. In Massachusetts in 2021, they received $1.2 billion in revenue. And that's about a similar size and population to Maryland. There's about 6.9 million people in Massachusetts. Altogether, collected in all the states that have a recreational regulated market, there's $3.7 billion in sales, and that's according to the Marijuana Policy Project.
And is the amount of tax revenue generated expected to cover the costs of setting up this industry to the state?
I think that is a question that still remains to be answered.
What has been the most interesting part of this process to you?
For me, I took the opportunity to go out and talk to some of the growers and dispensary owners, and it was eye-opening for me to see how massive this operation is. I went out and visited a grower in Cecil County who has hundreds of thousands of square footage of canopy, massive automated processes for growing cannabis at every stage. And I just couldn't believe how established it already was. It just seems like, this process has been happening. It's just the size of it and the scope of it. It's also interesting to me how the legislature is being very intentional with every step in how they're setting up licensing, but they're also trying to open the doors to social equity applicants to right some of the harms that have been done to communities of color when it comes to cannabis prohibition.
Yeah, that scope is especially striking when you realize this is still a federally prohibited substance, that it's moving so fast. And speaking of fast, the clock is counting down. Sine die is a week from Monday on April 10th. How far apart are the House and Senate?
I don't think they're that far apart. The version that the Senate is looking at right now, they worked off the House version. And they didn't change very much, but they, moved around some of the numbers here and there, as we discussed. So they will likely have to iron some of these things out as we move further down the road. But like I said, there are differences. And, you know, we're only how many days away? It's April 10th. So they have some work to do and they have some discussions to have before it's all said and done.
Brenda, thanks for bringing us up to date.
Thank you for having me.
Brenda Wintrode covers state government and politics for the Baltimore Banner. We have links to her reporting on the General Assembly's work on recreational cannabis at the On the Record page at WYPR.org. I'm Sheila Cast. Glad you're with us on the record. Come back tomorrow.